Outsider by Meher Pestonji. Read for you by Pratap Sharma. Teresa slammed the door behind her, flung her bag onto the bed, and stormed into the bathroom to splash water on her red-hot face. As the tap gushed onto her sweater, she peeled it off, threw it into a basin of soapsuds, and smacked handfuls of cold water on her cheeks, neck, breasts. A few minutes of this helped her cool down. She shut off the tap, continuing to stand in the bathroom, the waistband of her jeans absorbing drops from rivulets running down her body. Sinking her face into the softness of a towel, she looked for a T-shirt. There wasn't one in the bathroom, but it didn't matter. Her bedroom door was shut. Though the curtains were not drawn, the expanse of sea afforded more privacy than the locked door. Topless, she walked to the window, inhaling deeply. Breathe in. Hold. Breathe out. Hold. Breathe in. As she'd learnt in yoga. 30-odd breaths later, she felt the calm returning. Only then did she realize that her eyes were still shut. She opened them to catch a flock of seagulls take off from the waters around the Haji Ali Dargah, a tiny offshore island connected to the city by a narrow footpath thronged by Hindu and Muslim devotees at all times of the day. The sight never failed to delight her. With the sun about to dip into the western horizon, pink flecks circled the sea in sweeping curves before coming to rest on the dome, minarets, and on the bobbing waves. She often wondered how gulls flew so close without wings crashing into tragedies. But in the 4 months she had been observing them from her window at Eden Hall, not once had there been an accident. She looked into the mirror to find her face no longer flushed. Sitting on the bed, she pulled off her jeans and went back into the bathroom for a shower. As needles of cold water beat against her head and back, she felt the last dregs of tension ease. She shouldn't have lost her temper so impetuously, she told herself. Kawas and Zinnia had been decent with her. They were a young couple from the privileged strata of society, and since she was in India to study the underprivileged, contrasts were bound to surface. In 2 months, she'd be back in Munich and have time to reflect on her divergent experiences of India. Reaching for a towel, she rubbed herself dry, slipping into the cotton kaftan she'd bought on her first day in Bombay. The green and white print offset her red-brown hair, highlighting her blue-green eyes. She rubbed moisturizer on her face, hands, legs, and then went back to the window, watching lights come on in skyscrapers across the bay. Eden Hall had one of the best views in Bombay. The sea, licking the edges of a curved boulevard, dotted with speeding cars, beyond which she could see the emerald green turf where horse races were held on weekends. There was a knock at the door, and Zinnia called, "Ready for a drink?" "Coming," she replied, conscious that such social niceties were not part of the paying guest contract, which covered only the room, breakfast and dinner. Their generosity made them include her in their social life, getting her invited to the homes of their friends and taken on weekends to the countryside. Her Bombay visit would have been far more austere had she not been staying with the Shroffs. She found Carvis in the drawing-room, furnished with blue-green upholstery and matching drapes, blue and white chinaware, displayed in a showcase along the wall. "Beer for you as usual," he asked, and was about to pop a can of Kingfisher, when she stopped him. "I'll have gin and tonic today," she said. "I need something cool."
"Beer's cool."
"That's what Indians say. In Germany we have beer in winter. Anyway, Carlos, I want to apologize. I shouldn't have lost my shirt as I did."
"Apology unnecessary," replied, brushing aside her discomfort. "Foreigners are oversensitive to poverty. We are inoculated against it from birth. Vaccinations against polio, tuberculosis, and the invisible vaccine that blinds us to unsightly images. Without the last vaccine, we'd be miserable every day of our lives. Don't you think we need it in India?"
She squirmed at his condescension, but there was also some truth in what he said. The Indian rich seemed unperturbed by the inhuman conditions in which people lived barely yards away from themselves. "The blind spot may be a survival strategy, as Kaas implied, but Teresa felt it just wasn't right. She thought it prudent not to enter into an argument, but the next day narrated the incident to Jyoti, who was the guide for her doctorate thesis. A sociology student, Teresa was documenting the lives of street children in Bombay, while her research associates did the same with street children in Rio de Janeiro, Johannesburg, and Kuala Lumpur, after which they planned a comprehensive analysis. Jyoti had taken her step by step, introducing her to railway stations where runaway kids arrive in Bombay, to the beaches and bazaars where they sometimes find employment, to the free food distribution centres attached to places of worship, to the rubbish bins that hold treasures like throwaway combs for rag pickers, to street corners called addas, where kids as young as 10 got high on pot, drinks, drugs, and even by smelling the glue used by cobblers to seal the soles of shoes, and finally to the shelters run by non-government organizations where kids are free to come and go while social workers monitor their activities, stepping in to intervene when necessary. Teresa had been told to anticipate dirt and poverty in India, but was unprepared for the resilience and buoyancy of these kids who seemed more prepared for life than street kids in the West. They were street smart, with a cockiness that comes from being your own boss from an early age. Some were as young as 8 or 9, looking even younger due to malnutrition. Yet they'd learnt to survive in a big-fish-eat-little-fish environment, where they were the smallest fish of all. The boy came up to the car at the traffic lights, wiped the windshield with a duster, then tapped Kawa's window, asking for a tip. Teresa told Jyoti the day after she'd stormed off from the car. Kawas told him to get lost. When I took out some money from my handbag, he stopped me. "Don't encourage beggars. They work in gangs to fleece honest citizens like us," he said. Just then the lights changed, and he stepped on the accelerator, though the boy's hand was still on the car. "That boy might have been killed. In Germany you'd be arrested for doing that," I cried, turning back to see the boy jumping onto a road divider. "Do you know what he said, Jyoti?" "I remember his exact words. He said, 'The son of a bitch knows how to take care of himself. Anyway, there are millions of Chokra boys around. One more or less makes no difference.'" I was so shocked. I called him a bastard without a conscience and jumped out of the car. I don't know how I'm going to survive these people for 2 more months.
"You don't have to live there. If you want, we can find you hostel accommodation," said Jyoti, who after 4 months was familiar with Teresa's outbursts. Teresa fell silent. Eden Hall was the most luxurious apartment she had ever lived in. Nowhere in Europe could she have afforded such a place. Only the dollar exchange rate made it possible, and
despite the clash of ideals, she wanted to taste the pleasures of India even while studying her slums. She had got sucked into the Shroff's social whirl within a week of moving into Eden Hall. Cowas was short and stocky, with a pointed French beard, while his wife was petite, with cow-like eyes and frizzy hair fanning her heart-shaped face. They were part of a group of wealthy Parsis who met each week for dinner at one another's places. The men were practicing lawyers, doctors, or in managerial positions with leading private companies, while the women worked in ad agencies, airlines, or as secretaries to business magnates. Every 2 or 3 weeks, they would take off for a weekend at the seaside or a hill station, and periodically they would book a couple of rows in a cinema house where they'd troop in to see a popular film like Titanic. Initially, Teresa was flattered to find herself the center of attention. Not only did the men keep her glass filled and escort her to the dining table, introducing her to exotic Parsi cuisine, where fish came wrapped in banana leaves and chicken was cooked with dry apricots topped with potato straws, they also included her in their friendly banter, where the game of one-upmanship was acted out in verbal sparring. After a few weeks, however, she began to find the banter banal, with jokes being repeated long after the punchlines had lost their bite, as in family Christmas gatherings. Only these gatherings happened every week. "Nice auntie," someone might say while driving past an attractive young girl. "Yours or mine?" would come the response. "You make her your auntie, I'll pull down her panty." And the group would dissolve into peals of laughter. The first time it sounded funny, but as wit sank into stereotype, Teresa thought people chorusing the last line sounded like a children's recitation class. Unlike Jyoti, who wore a sari or the loose-fitting salwar kameez, the women in this group all wore Western clothes. They had holidayed in the West and were more keen on reliving their travel experiences with a foreigner than on informing her about local history or customs of which they seemed ill-informed. During the Ganpati festival, when the entire city reverberated to drums, music, and chants of Ganpati Bappa Moria, as giant-sized clay idols of the elephant god were immersed into the sea, they complained about the noise and traffic jams and could not tell her about the myth surrounding Ganesh. Their lives seemed centered around acquiring imported cosmetics, French perfumes, and Swiss chocolates and cheese. One pretty girl was an air hostess, providing a steady supply of goodies to them all. One evening, she announced she had bought 5 bottles of Yves Saint Laurent's opium to find 9 women clamoring for them. "If opium smells like opium, it must be deadly," quipped a man in a red checked shirt. "If opium tastes like opium, it would be deadlier," responded another in a safari suit. "If opium is opium, it's a killer, and will take our lovely ladies to Never Never Land," climaxed a third. As Teresa, who'd just seen an emaciated boy struggle through withdrawal, debated whether or not such jokes were in bad taste. She had started working as a volunteer at a day-and-night shelter to get an insight into the world of street kids, handing out medicines for cuts, coughs, diarrhea, engaging them in painting and clay modeling, listening to their case histories with the help of a translator. Most kids used the shelter only to sleep at night, going about their business of washing cars, hawking, sweeping, rag-picking during the day. Some came twice or 3 times a week, others barely twice a month. Santosh was the only boy she could communicate with,
for he spoke a smattering of English. He had arrived from Almora at the foothills of the Himalayas. His father was a government school teacher, drinking himself to oblivion each evening, often beating and sexually assaulting his wife, as Santosh and his sister cowered in a corner. When the 12-year-old could take it no more, he flung a large stone at his father. Then, seeing the older man slump in a stupor, had fled. "How did you learn English?" she asked Santosh in her heavily accented English, which the boy had some difficulty following. "In Almora Christian School, I study 7-class Hindi. From 4-class we do English. 1 hour, Father Bosco make class talk English only. On train, English useful for TC."
"What's TC?"
"Ticketwala. I know by ticket. When TC come, I say, 'I servant boy. Mem sahab have ticket in 1st class. If you say in English, TC believes. Or make me get off train, wait in jungle for other train."
"Don't you want to go home, Santosh?"
"No, Didi, I scared. If Baba dead, I go to jail. I make money in Mumbai. Call Ma here, sister also."
"If your father is dead, your mother might need you."
"Not like that. If I go, she send me school and work to feed me. Now she feed only sister."
Before she could probe deeper, Jyoti intervened. "Santosh will go into depression if he thinks too much about his family. Now cheer him up." Teresa took him to a fruit juice stall. But Santosh opted for an ice cream. Seeing him lick the fast-melting dribbles off his fingers, she offered him a second.
"No, Didi, you no have. How can I have 2, thank you?"
Contrasted against this, Kaur's attitude seemed unforgivable. An earlier instance of their group's insensitivity was clearly etched in Teresa's memory. 4 carloads had gone for a weekend to a lakeside. Adults, kids, and pedigreed dogs piled into cars that whizzed along the highway, overtaking petrol tankers and trucks at breathtaking speed. Teresa was used to speed, but not the haphazard traffic where bicyclists and pedestrians clung to the edge of the same road as speeding vehicles, which had to be as prepared for an ambling cow as for the dog, which might jump out of the bushes in a frenzy of aggressive barking. The lake waters were soothing after the drive. As the others unloaded cars in front of the bungalow where they would spend the night, Teresa waded into the water and was delighted to find her toes tickled by tiny fish. She bent down, cupping her hands to trap the barely visible shimmering streaks, laughing each time they slipped away.
"Use my handkerchief," called Savak, tossing her a large kerchief with a grey border.
Teresa dipped it in the water, raising it to find 2 silver slivers gasping for breath. Immediately she lured it again.
"Didn't you get anything?" he asked.
"They're tiny. Too small to eat. Catch them for fun."
"It stops being funny when they die."
"You're soft-hearted. I thought German girls were tough."
"Tough doesn't mean you have to be cruel." Savak paired up with her for that weekend, carrying her rucksack, helping her across moss-covered rocks, guiding the way to the waterfall, where they gazed at the slow cascading froth that appeared deceptively gentle. He was a burly 6-footer, with shaggy eyebrows, shading sharp eyes, and a long aquiline nose. Together, they carried one of the large hampers of food to the base of the waterfall. Sandwiches, sausages, lamb chops, and omelets were passed around as children gorged on coke and potato chips. Teresa sat perched on a rock under an overhanging tree, listening to the sound of gurgling water mingle with the laughter of children
aiming stones at a chameleon on a large rock. When a tin of Macintosh toffees was opened, 5-year-old Nishat threw her wrapper into the water, only to be pulled up and made to fish it out. All the litter, including empty Coke bottles, paper cups and plates, was collected and carried back to the cars. They were ready to return to the city when someone remembered the cheese sandwiches. Nobody, not even the dogs, with their happy wagging tails, wanted any more. Teresa had noticed a bunch of skinny kids when they arrived, but Carvers had shooed them away, threatening to set the dogs after them. "These blighters steal ACs and stereos from cars," he told Teresa, seeing the expression on her face. Teresa's heart had ached for the bedraggled kids, and now she volunteered to take them the leftover food.
"No, no, not those dirty children," said a busty woman whose thighs bulged below clinging shorts.
"Aren't there any dogs?"
asked another.
"The dogs have all eaten."
"Not our dogs, mountain dogs. We always give stray dogs the leftovers.
Why not give leftovers to kids?"
"They're full of lice. They never have a bath."
"How do you know?"
"We live here, so we know. Foreigners are too sentimental."
Teresa was angry at being put down, and felt revolted as she saw the fat woman feeding a scrawny dog while a boy and girl with bamboo stick legs and sun-bleached hair watched enviously. The next day she shared her disgust with Jyoti, who took it stoically. "I know the class divide is bad, but I didn't realize that some people prioritize stray dogs over starving human beings," she said dryly. When Santosh discovered she lived at Eden Hall, which was only a 30-minute walk from the shelter, he would often come for a dip in the ocean, and they would walk back together. Reaching the seafront an hour earlier, he'd clamber over rocks to the water's edge, strip down to a G-string, and wash his clothes, scrubbing and beating them against rocks to loosen particles of dirt. Spreading them out to dry, he'd splash among the waves before hauling himself out to dry in the sun like his clothes. Sometimes he would bring Teresa a gift from the sea. Shells, coconut kernels curled into unusual shapes, and once a live crab. Teresa refused to touch the crab, so Santosh, with mischief sparkling in his eyes, ran all the way to the shelter, dangling the wriggling creature between his fingers. For the rest of the day, he chased kids around with the crab till it ended its life in a pot of boiling aromatic spices. He never walked straight, bounding ahead with restless energy, a grin on his impish face. His eyes were constantly darting, searching for bottle caps to be scooped out of gutters or pavement corners near cold drink stalls. Teresa first thought he was collecting Pepsi, Goldspot, Mangola caps, the way kids collect stamps, to discover that for Santosh, these were a source of livelihood. Each week, he would take them to a recycling center, haggle over the price, then treat himself to the latest Hindi film. When the haul was good, he'd also splurge on mutton biryani, cooked in huge pots on the street by women at Grant Road, near the cinema houses he frequented. Savak started calling her up after the picnic. He invited her for a violin recital, for which he had received complimentary tickets from his bank, to go jogging at Mahalakshmi Racecourse, which she could see from her 11th-floor window, to sample lobsters at Trishna, a popular seafood restaurant. Like all Zinnia and Kawa's friends, he was proud of being a Parsi and lost no opportunity to impress his community's heritage on her. "We are not dark like Indians, because we come from Persia. We had to flee from there because of Islamic persecution. When our ancestors landed at Sanjan, 1300 years ago, the Hindu king granted asylum on certain conditions, that we adopt the local language and dress, that we don't intermarry with the local population and don't convert them to our religion. So, to this day, non-Parsis are not allowed to enter fire temples, he'd say, pointing to fire temples with the winged bull symbol as they drove past. We are an endangered species, with barely 100,000 Parsis left in the world, he told her another time. While Indians breed more and more, Parsis breed less and less. Parsi Panchayat is actually giving incentives to young couples to have more children, but it's having little effect. Who wants Panchayat trustees interfering in family affairs? After dinner at Trishna, he took her walking around the fort area, pointing out monumental floodlit buildings with Gothic columns and arches. All these are built by the Kawasji Jahangir family, he told her. Elphinstone College, the University Convocation Hall, Jahangir Art Gallery, and the CJ Hall, which has recently been converted to the Gallery of Modern Art. We Parsis built Bombay with the help of the British. See how these Ghatis have ruined it after the Britishers left? Ghati, she was to learn, was a derisive term for the local Maharashtrian population. On another evening, he spoke of Jamshedji Jiji Boy, who more than a century ago founded premier institutions for art and architecture, and also built a hospital for lower and middle-class patients of all communities. Lady Jiji Boy constructed the Mahim Causeway, connecting two of Bombay's seven islands from private funds, and refused to charge a toll, since that would make the arterial road inaccessible to the poor, said Savak, his voice swelling with pride. Jamshedji Jiji Boy was knighted by the British for his philanthropy. After him, people coined the phrase, Parsi, thy name is charity. You're always talking about the past. What great works are Parsis doing today? She asked. The Tatas are the most respected business house of the country, he replied. They started the first steel plant in India, the first hydroelectric works, the first engineering works, all before independence, planning for the future of the country. And now Ratan Tata has designed India's first indigenous car. From their profits, they built the best cancer hospital in the country, founded an institute for social sciences, another for research in the fundamental sciences. Imagine doing all this without black money in a country like India. But what about average Parsis? Are they all as effete and as pleasure-loving as your friends? Parsis love the good life, and our religion encourages it. We are not expected to be ascetic like Hindus. How can a community be considered charitable and yet be so blind to the poorest of the poor? The community takes pride in looking after its own. I can say with confidence that you won't find a single Parsi living in those huts or slums. I don't know why you keep going there. Why didn't you come to India to study something useful like architecture or the flora and fauna of the Himalayas? My work is useful. It's also satisfying. It's all right if you're earning dollars. Do you know what Indian social workers get? It hadn't occurred to her to compare salaries with Jyoti. Money isn't everything. You must believe in and enjoy what you're doing. You enjoy going to those dirty areas? Yes, I do. Not the dirt, but the fighting spirit of the kids inspires me. Their survival instinct is so strong. They travel to Bombay from all over the country with only a dream in their hearts. A dream to make big in a big city. A dream to hit the floodlights. A dream to be in the same city as their favorite film star. And perhaps peep into her car at a traffic junction. They've left behind homes and families in search of that dream. That's courage. It's insane. The city gets burdened with their dirty, sloppy ways, and
sentimental foreigners sing paeans to the filthy monsters?
She gave up. He was incapable of looking beyond the dirt and grime of physical reality. Yet she continued accepting his invitations, despite knowing their divergent views on almost every subject.
"You walk too slow, slow, Didi," Santosh would say, as she struggled with her dupatta in the breeze.
When she was with Savak or the Shroffs, she wore her German skirts and jeans, but at the shelter she felt cooler in the loose shalwar kameez, enjoying the soft feel of the dupatta around her shoulders. But this scarf-like garment was not easy to control when it was windy, and unless she anchored it around her neck till it almost throttled her, it threatened to fly away.
"Not good to fall, dupatta, Didi. You my sister, not that kind girl."
She couldn't figure out what he was getting at. Each time he'd insist, she straightened out her clothing before entering the shelter, and get visibly upset if she didn't. Finally, she asked Jyoti,
"Dropping the dupatta or pallu of a sari is a way of attracting men," she laughed. "It's a common gesture in old Hindi films."
"But I'm fully covered underneath."
"Santosh is from the conservative north. He feels protective about you. To him, dropping your dupatta is like cheapening yourself."
"He's only a kid. How can he be so patriarchal?" She was perplexed. How could fully covered breasts be considered more provocative than the bare midriff between the saris and cholis most women wore, she wondered. Acknowledging a special bond with Santosh, she often carried down the fruit from her breakfast tray for him. At high tide, she would have breakfast to the boom swish of the waves. She would watch the graceful gliding gulls diving between rocks to fish in the shallows. She had told Santosh she would be returning to Germany soon, but as the time neared, she found herself concerned about his future. Other kids resented the special attention he received from her. Some abused him, even in her presence. More than once, Jyoti warned her, "The boys are hungry for love. If you become a mother figure for Santosh, it'll be terrible for him when you leave." Teresa disagreed. She reasoned that since love was so scarce, every bit was precious. She had noticed that Santosh had a steady hand, that great detailing went into his paintings. So she asked Jyoti about enrolling him in a pottery class to give him a financially viable skill. She offered to pay the fees for a special class, preferably at a recognized institute.
"After so many months, you haven't understood the first thing about these kids, Teresa," retorted Jyoti, her dark eyes flashing impatiently. "What makes you think Santosh will attend class regularly? How will other kids treat him when they discover he doesn't have a home? Won't their taunts depress him? If pottery class isn't a good idea, what can I do for Santosh?"
"Anything you do for an individual is meaningless. We have to change the system. That's the only solution.
That'll take centuries. Meanwhile, lives have to be led. Maybe I can help improve just one life."
"I'm beginning to agree with your Parsi friends. You are a sentimentalist. Are you also going to say one child more or less makes no difference?"
"Of course not. But you can do more by creating awareness about these kids in the West than by handing out dole to one poor kid."
"I'll be doing the awareness bit as part of my project anyway. But that shouldn't stop me from doing something special for Santosh."
"What makes Santosh special? How is he different from the other kids at the shelter? only the fact that he speaks English. To single him out for special treatment would affect other kids without necessarily benefiting him. I feel awful abandoning him. I've been telling you to keep your distance, emotionally. Now you're going to experience withdrawal pains like he will. It's not just the parting, Jyoti. I want to do something to improve his life. You can't. I only hope you haven't destroyed his survival capacity. Reflecting on Jyoti's words depressed Teresa as she chewed on her toast. Her eyes fell on a line of amber-coloured ants labouring up the windowsill with the crumbs of her breakfast. Every crumb is precious to someone, she thought, wondering whether Santosh would be nibbled up bit by bit, or find the ingenuity to survive. The contrast between the high-flying lifestyle of Carver's friends and the street kids among whom she spent her days deepened Teresa's understanding of India, though she realized there was more to the country than monuments, slums, and an urban elite. The common thread running through her experiences was unpunctuality. And with the precision bred in her German character, this disturbed her more than the poverty or dirt, because it seemed easier to correct. It wasn't just trains and flights that were not on time. It was the people themselves. 10-15 minutes weren't considered much of a delay, whereas in Germany, a 2-minute delay in the arrival of a bus would have half the queue stamping in impatience, while a person being habitually late by a quarter of an hour would strain friendships. Here, no one thought Savak unpunctual when he'd arrived to pick her up at 8:15 or 8:20 after telling her to be ready by 8. Jyoti thought nothing of arriving at the shelter at 10:45 or 11 a.m. when her scheduled time was 10:30. In the early weeks, when Teresa was being taken through the guts and grime of the city, she would find herself waiting at VT Station or Chapati Beach, wondering whether she was at the right prearranged spot to find Jyoti sauntering up 20 minutes later without so much as an explanation. When they got to know each other better, she raised the issue. "Why does no one respect time in India? You're always late by 15-20 minutes. It's the traffic, the trains. You have to make allowances. If I can reach on time, why can't you?" "Relax, yaar. Why are you getting neurotic? 5-10 minutes here or there makes no difference." "Sometimes I'm waiting in the street in the hot sun." "Sorry." "I'm not complaining. There's so much happening in the cities, I can watch it for hours. But there's an ethic of valuing time. As long as work gets done, what difference do a few minutes make?" "Time has to be valued for itself. Apart from work, time for leisure and pleasure is also valuable. One's own time as well as other people's. Time wasted is time lost. Once lost, it can never be recovered." "You're getting philosophical. We only think of practicalities." Savak was more apologetic, acknowledging she had reason to feel miffed. "Sorry, but every traffic light was against me," he would say by way of an explanation. Or, "Just as I was leaving the office, the boss called. Luckily, I didn't have to cancel our evening." Occasionally, when he did arrive on time, there would be triumph in his voice, as if he had accomplished something special rather than conformed to a norm. "I made it on German time today," he would beam, looking as if he deserved a medal for this feat. On Teresa's last evening, Savak threw a farewell party for her. The previous day, he had given her a raw silk outfit with a skirt and softly scalloped blouse.
as she drew her head through the neckline and smoothed the fabric over her hips. She looked into the mirror to find the rust silk a perfect match for her hair, a colour she had never worn. She couldn't decide whether it suited her or made her look like a ripe tomato. Zinnia complimented her as she emerged from her room, and they went down to the car where Carvas was waiting. He drove slowly towards the traffic light, knowing it would stay red, for they were moving in the opposite direction of the rush hour crowds fleeing the city each night. They stopped, almost touching the bumper of the car ahead, when Teresa heard a tapping at her window.
"Santosh, what are you doing here at this time?"
The boy was sobbing and jabbering in a language she could not understand. She stepped out to have the child fling his arms around her for the first time since they met.
"My new clothes," she squealed,
as Kawas yelled at Santosh from the car. Just then the lights changed, and the cars behind them started hooting.
"Get inside!" screamed Zenia.
But Teresa could not extricate herself from Santosh's flailing arms.
"Carry on. I'll join you later," she called as impatient drivers hurled abuses at Kawas, afraid the short time signal would change again.
Holding Santosh firmly by the wrist, she led him to the pavement. But his hysteria did not abate. The parting pangs have started. I should have listened to Jyoti, she thought. Through the maze of jumbled words, she picked up three names: Raju, Mohan, Shafiq. With a start, she realized something had happened between Santosh and the three bullies of the shelter.
"Calm down, Santosh. Tell me slowly in English what happened."
"Didi, Didi, Raju, Mohan, Shafiq."
"They beat you up? Are you hurt?"
"More bad than beat, Didi, more bad. They know like you give me ice cream biscuit. Many days they say we teach you good when Firang Mem Sab leave. 2-3 times I give them biscuit. They want ice cream. How can I keep ice cream till night? 5-6 times they beat me. Leg, hand, head. I keep quiet. Tomorrow you leave Germany. I think I leave shelter. But Raju, catch me today."
And his voice trailed off in a fresh round of incoherent babbling. Carvas had parked the car and crossed over.
"Stop harassing the lady," he roared.
But Teresa put her arm protectively around Santosh, forgetting about her dress.
"He's been through a traumatic experience. I can't follow the language. Will you please interpret?"
Kaos looked peeved. "We're getting late for the party."
"This is an emergency. Please translate."
"I'll try," said Kaos reluctantly, not wanting to admit his Hindi wasn't good enough.
"What did Raju do?"
she asked Santosh. His lower lip trembled, but he remained silent in front of this aggressive stranger.
"I've never seen him like this in the 6 months I've known him," she told the disgruntled Kawas.
"He's acting, trying to get money out of you." She dismissed his jaundiced thought pattern, her mind sifting through the information she'd gathered over months, trying to guess what might have gone wrong.
"Did Raju do something which you can't say in English?"
she asked the disturbed boy. He nodded, his terror-stricken eyes fixed on her face.
"Did Raju rape you?"
He looked uncomprehending. She turned to Kawas.
"Ask him if he's been raped."
"What?"
"Ask him if he's been raped by Raju.
Have you gone crazy? Do you think I'd talk about such intimate matters to a stranger?
that to a beggar child?" retorted an incredulous Carvis. "Rape is not intimate."
"Stop wasting time, Teresa. Come to the car. Everybody's waiting. It's your farewell party."
"I can't leave till I know what's happened to Santosh."
"Look, the traffic cops got after Xenia."
"You carry on. I'll take a cab and join you later."
"Stop being stubborn, Teresa. Savak's waiting for you."
"I said I'll come later."
She turned back to Santosh, leading him towards the low wall along the seafront. They stood leaning against it and talked in low voices.
"Sex."
Suddenly the word came to him.
"Raju, sex me. From back. After Raju, Mohan. After Mohan, Shafiq."
"Was anyone around?"
"Raju called me to garden. Behind Jyoti Madam office. I no go. Raju, Shafiq, catch left hand. Right hand. Take me zabardasti. First they beat me. Hand, leg, back, front, like before. Then they talk about you. Firang Mem Sab have white skin. Firang Mem Sab have big watermelons. Then they pull shorts. Shafiq hold. Raju go inside. Again. Then Raju hold. Mohan go inside. All time I am screaming, crying. No one comes. Now they say they will do every day. I leave Bombay, Didi. I take night train."
"Calm down, Santosh. We must report this to Jyoti."
"You report, Didi. I go. I report. They kill me."
"You have to report this, Santosh. Those boys will rape others."
"You report. I go. I go to station now."
"Where will you go?"
"Anywhere. First train, anywhere."
"Just wait till I phone Jyoti."
You tell Jyoti, madam. Didi, I go. Salam. Goodbye. Bye-bye."
And he disappeared into the dark, weaving his way through the orange-red taillights of the crawling traffic. Teresa stayed by the sea for a long time, trying to collect her thoughts. When she managed to reach Savak's place, she was met with icy stares.
"I hope she doesn't have AIDS. She might infect us,"
she heard the fat woman remarking, loud enough for her to hear.